It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
In apparent Islamic State victory in Iraq, I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Shia militia are headed to the outskirts of the Iraqi city Ramadi at the direction of Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi following the capture of the provincial capital by the Islamic State group. The military and tribal forces that fled Sunday regrouped on the city's eastern edge in an apparent effort to block any IS advance toward Baghdad. Michael O'Hanlon is a national security analyst at the Washington-based Brookings Institution.
Now, it doesn't mean that over time ISIL is going to take Baghdad or control the country, and I still think over time ISIL will be defeated, but this is fairly bad news, and it also sets back the clock on what we had hoped would be by now a preparation for a counterattack against Mosul, the largest and most important city that ISIL holds. And yet, that would now seem to be even further into the future.
U.S. officials renewed U.S. support to Iraqis battling to retake the city. 8 coalition airstrikes have targeted the city since Sunday. Burundi's embattled president, Pierre Nkurunziza, Monday sacked both his defense and foreign ministers following last week's failed coup attempt by members of the military and amid continuing street protests in the capital, Bujumbura. Protesters opposed Mr. Nkurunziza's bid for a third term in next month's election took to the streets again in parts of the capital. They were chased away by troops who shot into the air. At least 15 have been killed during 3 weeks of unrest. Critics say the president is violating the Constitution's two-term limit, which helped end a bloody civil war in 2005. But the country's highest court has ruled Mr. Nkurunziza was elected to his first term by fellow lawmakers, not the voters. This is VOA News. More than 50 people are known dead following a massive landslide in Colombia that sent mud and water crashing onto homes in the northwest mountainous town of Santa Margarita. Dozens more were reported injured. The landslide occurred early in the morning while residents slept. The area had been hit hard by several days of heavy rains. The European Union Monday approved plans for a naval operation aimed at disrupting human trafficking networks that have sent thousands of Middle East and African migrants on the dangerous journey on the Mediterranean to Europe. EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini said she expects the operation to be fully implemented by next month.
Hopefully, already at the next Foreign Affairs Council in June, we might be ready to adopt the launch of the operation. That will obviously have to follow the recommendations or the preparatory work that the commander will have in the coming weeks.
More than 10,000 migrants have been rescued from the Mediterranean in recent weeks, often in overcrowded and unseaworthy vessels launched from Libya. It's estimated that nearly 2,000 have died so far this year attempting the dangerous crossing. UN officials have expressed alarm over the killing of large numbers of civilians and the latest upsurge of violence in South Sudan's Unity and Upper Nile states. UN official Toby Lanzer has heard reports of the targeted killings and rape of civilians, including children. He said the latest fighting has left over 650,000 people without access to aid, with thousands of homes burned. The government claims the army is pushing south from Bentiu, capital of Unity, towards the opposition zone around the town of Leer. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met Monday with South Korean President Park Geun-hye and her foreign minister in Seoul, discussing security on the Korean Peninsula and bilateral issues. Mr. Kerry blasted North Korea for not even coming close to taking the steps needed to rein in its nuclear and missile programs.
Instead, it continues to pursue nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. It continues to break promises and make threats. And it continues to show flagrant disregard for international law while denying its own people the protection of fundamental freedoms and human rights.
The Secretary of State said it's likely the North will be referred to the International Criminal Court if its current violations of human rights continue. Tens of thousands of Macedonians turned out Monday supporting Prime Minister Nikola Gruevski's government in a counter-protest after opposition supporters marched to the capital Skopje a day earlier demanding his resignation. The opposition accuses Mr. Gruevski of corruption, tapping the telephones of thousands of people and fomenting ethnic tensions to hang on to power. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 19th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. West African leaders meet today in Ghana's capital, Accra.
They will also review the situation relative to the Ebola virus disease and the progress that is being made to eradicate the sickness from our shores.
Hannah Tete is Ghana's foreign minister. We'll look at how religion is helping to bring down Ebola cases in Sierra Leone. South Sudan rebels accuse government forces of bombing civilian targets, and an explanation why Burundian President Nkurunziza sacked his defense and foreign ministers.
We don't have only to link this with the failed coup, but maybe all the process, even if the president finds that they failed in at some way, he has to replace them.
Well, Nyamitwe is senior advisor to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. The European Union approves a military plan to target migrant smugglers, and the ILO says salary and work are on the decline globally. Those stories plus Marco Oman's Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, are meeting today, Tuesday, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, under the chairmanship of Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama. The first of two meetings this year. Ghanaian Foreign Minister Hannah Tete says the meeting will consider an array of issues affecting the sub-region, including the threat posed by Boko Haram and the crisis in Mali. The meeting also comes at a time when the Ebola epidemic in the sub-region appears to be on a decline in Liberia, but still a challenge in Guinea and Sierra Leone. Tete said ECOWAS is optimistic that in the next few months, the region will be able to celebrate a break in transmission of the Ebola virus in Guinea and Sierra Leone.
Well, the situation is as follows. In Liberia, there has been a break in transmission of the Ebola virus because they have gone for 42 days without any new infection. In Sierra Leone, they had begun the countdown. They had 8 days without any new infection. Unfortunately, on the 9th day, they recorded another illness, but all the people who had been in touch with that particular individual have been quarantined. They are looking to contain the situation and then get back to counting down the days within which they hoped there would have been a break in transmission. And the same is also happening within Guinea. So all told, even though in the other two member states, the Ebola virus has not yet been completely eliminated and we haven't been able to record a break in transmission, there's been a significant reduction in the number of new infections. We are optimistic that by the time we have the next ECOWAS meeting, indeed, we have been able to celebrate a break in transmission in Sierra Leone and also in Guinea.
Madam Foreign Minister, it seems security-wise the sub-region is still very challenged. You mentioned the situation with security being on the agenda. We have Boko Haram in Nigeria that kind of laid low during the Nigerian election, but it doesn't seem that that organization has gone away. We have Mali. Mali is still a problem. What is the sub-region's plan now, how to go about dealing with these hot regions?
The situation is as follows. Over the last couple of months, the various parties and stakeholders in what is referred to as the Inter-Malian Dialogue have been going through a process of negotiations which was facilitated by Algeria. As a result of that process of negotiation and discussion on what should be the future of Mali, last Friday there was the signing of the Inter-Malian Dialogue Accord in Bamako. And so having gotten to the point where there is now a final agreement on the way forward with regard to the peace process and the whole process of ensuring greater decentralization of power within the various parts of the country. And there is a roadmap for making progress on that. We're optimistic that with that process of engagement, there will be a better effort towards building and consolidating the peace. With regard to the situation with Boko Haram in northeastern Nigeria, Boko Haram has been degraded. It's not as if they've gone into hiding. They actually have been degraded because of a continuous engagement with the forces of Boko Haram by the armed forces of Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. But that notwithstanding, there is a need to continue to focus on this matter because it's important that we are able to have peace and stability return to that part of our continent.
Is there a satisfaction with the situation in Burkina Faso, or there's still an impasse?
There is no impasse. In Burkina Faso, what is happening is that there is a transition government in place that is making the necessary preparations to take the country towards elections. The elections have been scheduled for the 11th of October. Preparations towards having those elections are ongoing.
Ghanaian Foreign Minister Hannah Tete was speaking with me from the capital, Accra, where West African leaders are meeting today, Tuesday. Ebola cases are continuing their downward trend in Sierra Leone. As Nina De Vries reports from Freetown, religious leaders have contributed to the progress by helping to educate people in their churches and mosques.
Sierra Leone is a religious country, but what makes it somewhat unique is the religious tolerance. Muslims and Christians respect each other's beliefs. Now, religious leaders are taking things a step further by working together to eradicate Ebola. In mosques and churches, the leaders are taking examples from the Bible and Quran to teach people about Ebola prevention. The idea came from a local organization called Focus 1000. It recognized the importance of working with well-respected and trusted faith leaders. Reverend Christiana Sutton Karoma says people were reluctant to accept the importance of Ebola quarantine until it was explained in church.
But that is one key thing also the scripture tells us in Leviticus 13, that when somebody is infected with an infectious skin disease, that individual or that community should be quarantined.
It's important for anyone associated with Ebola to be quarantined as the virus is spread through direct contact with bodily fluids. When Reverend Karoma explained this from the Bible and how it relates to Ebola, people started to listen. The religious references are helping raise awareness, says Lamaratu Kamara, who attends the church.
I've seen it in my own community. I've seen it a lot in my own community. And now, thanks be to God, that we all take any precaution.
Dr. Ramadan Jallo is an imam in Freetown and is taking examples from the Quran to preach about Ebola in the mosque.
Islam has warned against anything that will endanger the life of an individual. So if you're going to wash this body, touch this body, and that's going to cause, lead you into problem, then Islam is warning against such an act.
Aid agency World Vision is doing similar work with faith leaders across the country. World Vision National Director Leslie Scott says it's because of the religious tolerance the leaders have been able to work so well together. Ebola has killed more than 3,000 people in Sierra Leone since the virus spread here almost a year ago. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
A senior advisor to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has been given details on what led to the sacking of the country's defense and foreign ministers just days after an unsuccessful coup d'etat. Willy Nyamitwe, senior advisor, media and communication, said the president did not sack the two because of their involvement in the aborted coup, but rather they were relieved of their portfolios because Mr. Nkurunziza needs efficiency in the running of his cabinet.
We don't have only to link this with the failed coup, but maybe all the process, even if the president finds that they failed in some way, he has to replace them.
So is the president saying that both the defense minister and the foreign minister, did they have anything specifically to do with the failed coup?
No. We are not saying that they have anything to do with the coup. But you know, when there is a coup, when the country has, we had to know what happened, what led the country to the coup. Not because they have anything or something to do with the coup, but in how the government is working and how the members are working only. So we need to have a very powerful foreign affairs minister as well as defense minister who can follow all the rules of the country. So if one of them comes and don't respect all the requirements from the president, he has to be replaced.
If the foreign minister is not connected with the coup, then could it be that he's fired because Burundi's foreign relations are not articulated enough?
No. He was not connected with the coup. No. But we do believe that when we look at how things are, maybe the Minister of Foreign Affairs could have done a lot, but maybe he didn't do enough to promote relations between Burundi and other countries. So the president had no choice but replaced him.
I think someone on the outside will look at it and say, no, President Nkurunziza has problems with his people, some of the people who are protesting against his decision to run for a third term. That's where the problem is. It's not with the defense minister or the foreign minister.
I don't think so. Yes, we have people from the opposition that are protesting against the decision from the ruling party to appoint Mr. Pierre Nkurunziza as the candidate for the 2015 presidential election. But replacing those ministers has nothing to do with this candidacy. No, because all the ministers that have been fired were supporting him to this candidacy. But what he do need is efficiency.
Efficiency.
Yes, the president has replaced them because he needs efficiency in the cabinet.
In the meantime, there were protests again on Monday, and the military has replaced the police. There's some suggestion from some military people that they are not the police. They will shoot live bullets at the protesters. Is that the case?
We do believe that these demonstrations are linked with the failed coup because they have same goals. And the government said, okay, so now we've seen that you have same goals and that you are really linked. None is allowed to go again into the streets and demonstrate.
Willie Nyamitwe is the senior advisor on media and communication to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 19th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. The spokesman for the forces loyal to renegade South Sudan People's Liberation Army commander, Johnson Olani, is accusing the South Sudan Army of bombing civilian targets in Upper Nile State. Brigadier General Nyangwa Ajak Deng says his forces shot down two helicopter gunships in Fashoda County in Upper Nile on Sunday. Deng says the South Sudan Army is attacking camps for people who have been escaping the weekend fighting for control of Malakal town.
The government of Juba, they came yesterday and they bombed the area of IDPs, the one that ran away from Malakal, who are being served by international community in Kamu Food and others, in Wawshuluk and in Ituok, the area and Kodok, and also the bomb in Ditang and Malakal. Ditang is just a few minutes from Malakal town. What happened is that the two planes were gunned down, the one during midday and the other one around 5 in the evening. Those gunships were gunned down of the Pechoda County.
Who was operating the planes?
The government of Juba.
So the plane belongs to the government of South Sudan?
They brought them through Uganda.
Yeah, you're saying that they bombed an IDP camp. How many people were injured or killed in the IDP camps?
No, they were fearing. They were bombing very fast. So they dropped only one bomb each, and then they could not have much effect. No, the issue is that not because we joined the SPLM in opposition, but maybe there is a communication or because of the decision that we have taken. Because we made it very clear that we are going to cooperate with all the forces that are fighting for the downfall of the government of Juba. We are a separate movement. We are called Agole Forces.
That was Brigadier General Nyangwa Ajak Deng, spokesman for a group loyal to renegade SPLA commander Major General Johnson Olani. You're speaking with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. Faced with calls for quick action after the deaths of hundreds of migrants on the Mediterranean this year, the European Union agreed on Monday to set up a naval mission to crack down on smuggling rings at sea. Lisa Bryan has more for VOA from Paris.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, speaking after a meeting of EU foreign and defense ministers, said she hoped the new naval mission in the Mediterranean will be established by next month.
There is a clear sense of urgency in this respect, also because we all know very well that June is the beginning of summer, and in this operation, seasons are important. And as summer comes, more people are traveling, and we want to have, at least I would like to have, the operation in place as soon as possible.
The operation aims to capture and destroy smugglers' boats off the coast of Libya, and the EU is seeking authorization from the United Nations to do so. Mogherini says it also means cooperation and action on the part of Libyan authorities.
Because there is a responsibility that the European Union can take, but there is, first of all, a responsibility that the Libyans themselves have to take on their territory, on their borders, being them land borders or sea borders. So we're looking for partnership.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg attended the meeting and said extremist groups operating in Libya and elsewhere in the region are another part of the migration problem.
One of the problems is that there might be foreign fighters, there might be terrorists also trying to hide, to blend in among the migrants.
The naval action is part of broader EU efforts to address the growing number of migrants trying to flee war and hunger in Africa and the Middle East. Nearly 50,000 migrants have crossed the Mediterranean for Europe this year. Hundreds of others have died trying to do so. The European Commission, the EU executive arm, has also announced plans to take in 20,000 more refugees over the next 2 years. But a number of countries, including Britain, France, and Poland, oppose the Commission's efforts to establish quotas for asylum seekers. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The International Labour Organization says a decrease in traditional forms of labour is leading to increased poverty because of widespread insecurity in the global jobs market. In this year's World Employment and Social Outlook 2015 report, the ILO examines the changing nature of jobs, as Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report at ILO headquarters in Geneva.
The so-called company man who could rely on a steady job, salary, and a pension at the end of his work life is an endangered species. New data shows fewer than one in four workers today is employed in this stable, traditional form of labor. The International Labor Organization's report analyzed employment trends in countries covering 84% of the global workforce. It finds three-quarters of workers are employed on temporary or short-term contracts in informal jobs or in unpaid family jobs. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says more than 60% of all workers, most of them in the developing world, lack any kind of employment contract. He adds, even among those workers who have a wage and salary, less than half have permanent work contracts.
One consequence of this type of transformation in the employment relationship is that it is contributing to the growing divergence between labour incomes and productivity, with productivity growing faster than wages in much of the world, which we think has been an important factor in the current employment crisis. And our report estimates that the loss in global demand as a consequence of employment trends coming from the crisis stands at $3.7 trillion US dollars.
Latest ILO estimates put the number of unemployed workers globally at 201 million, 30 million more than before the 2008 global economic crisis struck. Ryder says the shift from the traditional employment relationship to non-permanent forms of employment is leading to growing unemployment and a rise in inequality and poverty rates in many countries.
Temporary and informal workers, part-timers, unpaid family workers, many of them women, are disproportionately affected by poverty and by social exclusion. And by and large, the non-standard forms of employment go with lower pay and lesser coverage of social protection.
Ryder adds, data from a majority of countries find part-time jobs outpace gains in full-time work between 2009 and 2013. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with rugby. New Zealand beat South Africa 24-14 in the plate final as Kenya dismissed Argentina 26-12 in the ball final at the men's IRB 7 series in London on Sunday. At the conclusion of the nine-leg series, South Africa is second on the final standings with 154 points. Kenya is 13th with 46 points, while Zimbabwe is 20th with 1 point. Consequently, South Africa, Fiji, New Zealand, England and hosts Brazil qualify for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. The African Olympic qualifier will be staged in South Africa later this year. Staying in London, South Africa beat Brazil 14-7 to place 11th at the Women's IRB 7 Series tournament on Saturday. South Africa is at the bottom of the series standing in the 12-nation contest with 8 points. In Portugal, Tonga thrashed Namibia 45-11 in Men's World Rugby Under-20 Trophy in Lisbon on Saturday. Namibia play Hong Kong in their final Group B tie on Wednesday. Moving on to football, Swaziland edged Tanzania 1-0 as Madagascar pipped Lesotho 2-1 at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup preliminaries at the Royal Bafokeng Sports Palace in Pokeng, Northwest Province in South Africa on Monday. Early on Sunday, Zimbabwe beat Mauritius 2-0 as Namibia and Seychelles drew 0-0. Today, Tuesday, Seychelles play Zimbabwe as Namibia engage Mauritius. Turning to athletics, Ethiopia's Almaz Ayana clocked 14 minutes and 14.32 seconds to win the women's 5,000 meters in the third fastest time ever at the IAAF Diamond League in Shanghai, China on Sunday. Nigeria's Blessing Okagbare Ighoteguonor won the women's 100 meters as Kenya's Jairus Kipchoge Birech, Silas Kiplagat and Eunice Sum prevailed in men's 3,000 meters steeplechase, 1,500 meters and women's 800 meters respectively. Finally, in Qatar, Djibouti's Ayanla Suleiman and Ethiopia's Hagos Gebrehiwet prevailed in men's 800 meters and 3,000 meters respectively at the IAAF Diamond League in Doha on Friday, while Ethiopian Dawit Seyaum and Kenyan Virginia Nyambura carried the day in the women's 1,500 meters and 3,000 meters steeplechase respectively. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nigeria's military says it has destroyed 10 Boko Haram camps and killed an unknown number of terrorists as part of its continuing offensive against the militants in the northeastern Sambisa forest. Military spokesman Lieutenant Colonel S.K. Osma told VOA's Hausa service that the Dure camp, one of the most prominent camps in the forest, was among those that fell on Saturday. He said one soldier was killed by a landmine and two others were wounded during the operation. Osman said officials are still counting the number of casualties as well as the number of people rescued from the camps. Nigeria, along with neighbors Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, recently launched an offensive to end the Boko Haram insurgency, which has claimed more than 10,000 lives and displaced some 1.5 million people in northeastern Nigeria from their homes. The United Nations Security Council has condemned fighting in two northern states in South Sudan and the repeated violations of ceasefire agreement the government and rebels signed early last year. In a statement, the council said a government military offensive in Unity State caused large-scale violence that has forced 100,000 people from their homes and halted aid delivery to civilians in the area. The council also blamed the rebels for launching an attack on the town of Malakal in Upper Nile State. A bloc of East African nations that has been trying to mediate the conflict between President Salva Kiir's government and rebels backing former Vice President Riek Machar said it was deeply frustrated. That is it for this Tuesday, May 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butt in Washington, hoping that all of you in Africa will have a great day.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Country AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.